Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
200 years ago, on this very day, April the 19th, was the death of the British poet, Lord Byron, George Gordon, Lord Byron. He brought forth, of course, the eponymous Byronic hero. His works have inspired musicians from Liszt to Leonard Cohen. And despite a reputation for being a bit of a rogue, he is still regarded today as one of the great poets. So to reflect on his legacy, we're joined now by Associate Professor of English from the University of Otago, Thomas McLean. Kia ora to you, Thomas.
Kia ora. Welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. I put this to you, of all the Romantic poets, maybe all the poets full stop, Byron is the one whose life to me sounds most like a Michael Bay movie. Your thoughts on that somewhat crass statement there?
Well, I do think that, you know, he's a funny figure in the sense that, you know, he's clearly one of the great poets of the 19th century. He's admired by everybody. He's imitated by everybody. Painters and composers, as you said, and other writers are all obsessed with his poetry and his life. These days, we've kind of forgotten the poetry, at least to a certain extent, but the life continues to fascinate us. And it is, you know, that capital R romantic life, just a remarkable mix of romance, but also really revolutionary behavior at times, going against society, you know, having to live in exile in his later years. It is quite a remarkable life, and it's no wonder that we keep going back to it.
Yes, I mean, his death is in and of itself, you know, poem worthy. Tell us a bit about it. He died at the age of 36. Almost a ripe old age among the Romantic poets, and in a very, as you say, capital R romantic sort of environment, it would be fair to say.
Yeah, for sure. You know, he had gone to Greece because the Greeks were fighting against the Ottoman Empire, trying to regain their independence. Byron had always been fascinated by the Mediterranean world. He had spent time in Greece and Turkey and Albania and Italy. And in that final year, he decided to, you know, put his money where his mouth was. And he left. He had been living in Italy before that. And he took a ship out to Greece and a whole lot of money. And he helped to, as much as he could, to fund the Greek freedom fighters. Mm-hmm. And while he was there, he didn't actually see actual combat, although, like I said, he did give a lot of his own money to the resistance. And he became quite ill while he was there. The doctors thought it was wise to bleed him, which, in fact, was probably the worst thing to do. Instead of getting better, he got worse and he died. His remains, most of his remains, returned to England eventually, although his life, he had been, you know, gone from being from famous to infamous in Britain. In Greece, he's still to this day a kind of national hero. Yeah. You know, even before he actually went to Greece, he had written in poetry very strongly about the, you know, about the Elgin Marbles, mm-hmm. the the great Greek sculptures that were on the Parthenon and then were taken away and are now in the British Museum. And even back then, Byron, saw this as a horrible act of thievery by the British. And so, for that, for his love of Greece and for his fighting for the Greeks, all of these things, and writing poetry in praise of Greece, he's a kind of a international hero, but certainly a hero in Greece.
You talk about how, perhaps the mythology around Byron has sort of grown or maybe is appreciated now disproportionately in terms of when compared to the quality of his poetry. He did live a fascinating life, though, didn't he? I mean, he was sort of, would it be fair to say he was sort of, scandal was in the blood almost?
Well, I think, yeah, that's probably about right. He was born in 1788. His father is called Mad Jack Byron. I think he was a veteran of the American Revolution, fighting on the British side of things. And he was not much of a presence in George Gordon Byron's life. He was not around much, and then he died when he was quite young. And Byron becomes Lord Byron when he's about 10 years old. And, a number of sort of unexpected deaths had to occur for that to happen. And suddenly he is kind of thrust into this position of power as a lord. He becomes a member of the House of Lords. But he's always more interested in travel and in writing poetry. And he writes some verse, gets some attention, but it's a long work called Childe Harold's Pilgrimage that really kind of cements his fame. And as he says, I think in a letter, I woke up to find myself famous. Suddenly he is, one of the most famous poets, writers in Britain. And what follows from that is a lot of fascination with him, because at the center of Childe Harold is this figure of this, what we would now call the Byronic hero, this sort of moody, dour male figure, handsome, but has some kind of a secret, pain, some kind of suffering that is never often explained. But it shapes their personality. And of course, a lot of people saw in Childe Harold and in some of the protagonists of Byron's later poems, they saw Byron himself. And there's a whole at the National Library of Scotland, there is a whole collection of fan mail written mostly by women to Lord Byron, kind of in the aftermath of his poetic fame. Because I think there was, this real desire to kind of see Byron as this sort of damaged figure, like his Byronic heroes. And so the person himself, there was a fascination around him and his beauty. But of course, that Byronic hero takes off in sort of, ways that Byron, I'm sure, didn't even expect. If you think through literary history, figures like Heathcliff from Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, there would be no Heathcliff if not for Byron. There's a fine new biography of Byron by Andrew Stauffer, and he kind of brings it up, to figures like Neil Gaiman's Dream. That even to this very day, you've got figures who are, shaped by that Byronic hero figure.
We got a text through earlier today when I was talking about how we were going to be talking about Byron from Scott in Littleton, who wrote the best Byron reference in Scott's view is the 1980s Ken Russell movie, which I think is called Gothic, and that sort of delves as well into the writing of Frankenstein, and indeed he was also fascinated with vampires as well, wasn't he?
Yes. Good. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah. So Byron leaves Britain in disgrace. He gets married to a very intelligent young woman named Annabella Milbank, becomes Lady Byron. And he clearly treats her terribly. There's certain questions about what exactly happened, but he was certainly having affairs. He was certainly having mental issues of his own. And he was probably having some kind of a physical relationship with a half-sister. So a lot was going on. Byron leaves Britain in 1816 and settles in Switzerland, where he connects up with his new friends, Percy and Mary Shelley. Mm. Percy Shelley is another terrific poet of the day, not nearly as famous as Byron at the time. And of course, Mary Shelley is today known for her novels and in particular for Frankenstein. Mm. And it was in 1816, the so-called summer, what was the year without a summer, because the weather was so miserable and dark and gray and stormy. And they sat around telling ghost stories and trying to see who could write the best story. Mary came up with the idea for Frankenstein and saw that through. Lord Byron started work on a vampire story, and then he put it aside. But his doctor, a guy named John Polidori, picked up that fragment and continued to work on it, unbeknownst to Lord Byron. And he produced a story called The Vampire. And that figure of the vampire in Polidori's story is, again, you can see a strong resemblance to Lord Byron himself in the main figure. And again, Andrew Stauffer, the Byron's recent biographer, makes the argument, and I think it's very reasonable that, you know, that whole series of vampires, to Dracula and beyond, Anne Rice, figures like that, go back to, can be, traced back to Polidori's story, and also to the fragment that Byron wrote, which was later published as well.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. I mean, you observed earlier that Heathcliff wouldn't exist without Byron, but then again, I suppose perhaps neither would Twilight in all likelihood. So, you know, you win some, you lose some, don't you?
Yes.
Thomas, just finally, 200 years to this very day, the death of Lord Byron. What is a poem that you would recommend to our audience to mark the occasion in style, please?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. I mean, there's lovely poems by Byron. She Walks in Beauty is a lovely poem. You mentioned Leonard Cohen. So Will No More Go A-Roving is a kind of a, post-party kind of a poem. I mean, start with some of the short stuff to get you going. The great poem, Byron's great work, is also his longest work. It's a poem called Don Juan. Now, you would look at the title and think it's Don Juan.
Yeah.
But in order to make the rhyme work, Byron is being a bit perverse and making you call the character Don Juan. Mm. It's everything that, you would want in a romantic poem, or really just a great poem. I mean, it's funny. It's scary at times. It's very exciting. But again, that's a big undertaking. It's a wonderful undertaking, but
indeed.
With Byron, there's a lot of good stuff. Good stuff to find.
And quite serendipitous, both of your recommendations, because actually, She Walks in Beauty is the poem that you taught me about 15 years ago at the University of Otago, and we are about to play Leonard Cohen's rendition of Go No More A-Roving. So look at that! Couldn't have written it better.
Excellent.
Thomas McLean from Otago University, thanks so much for your time this evening.
It's been my pleasure.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.